This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Tommy Campbell was the greatest boxer you've never heard of. In the late 1940s and early 50s, the Kansas City, Kansas native became the world's number two ranked lightweight fighter. He won almost as many fights as Muhammad Ali. But his boxing career was cut short when he stood up against mob-controlled promoters and boxing matchmakers. Casey Currents' Susan Wilson recently caught up with author Phil Dixon, who tells a story in his upcoming book, Tommy Campbell, A Boxing Bout with the Mob. Dixon tells Susan that he actually grew up across the street from the mother of the man known as the Chocolate Ice Cube.
Tommy was a guy, he didn't get too high, he didn't get too low. They used to say that he would come in the ring like a preacher. And, you know, he didn't say much. He was really a calm guy, but you put a pair of gloves on him, and, you know, he would just, you know, he would just dominate. And so they said, man, this guy is, like, really cool. And of course, you know, coming from the period they were in, you know, they used a lot of kind of racial things that they would connect the name. So, you know, like Joe Louis was the Brown Bomber or something like that. So anyway, they gave him the Chocolate Ice Cube. And the name stuck. It was a writer for the L.A. Times who tagged him as the Chocolate Ice Cube.
So now we're talking about the late 40s, early 50s. What was the climate like at that point for African-American boxers?
It was one of the greatest period for African-American boxers. Most of the champions at that time, unfortunately, were controlled by the mob. And so who fought who? And who was to take a dive to another fighter so they could build up another fighter, that type of thing, to fight for the title. A lot of this was controlled by mobsters, and there was this great anticipation to find out how it worked so that they could end it. But it affected the careers of many outstanding African-American fighters.
When you talk about the role of the mob at that time, what was their role, though? How would you describe some of their activities at that time?
Well, one of the things was they would become managers of the fighters. So you had, like, Blakey Palmero, who was he was the manager of Ike Williams, for instance. Ike Williams was a world champion. And everyone knew he had mob connections. He was the mob, and everyone knew that. But he was able to still manage a fighter. And there are other cases where people who were not, like, say, known to be mobsters, they were connected to mobsters. So if you wanted to have a title fight, if a particular mobster didn't have a piece of you, you wouldn't get that fight.
Uh-huh.
And then they would arrange fights. Some of the matchmakers work for the mob. And so they would arrange certain fights. They were breaking all the rules of boxing and a fair play and getting away with it.
And the throwing of the fights was mainly to win money because of betting on fights or changing the position of other fighters or exactly what motivated that?
Yes, you're correct. You're correct. The gambling that was connected. If there were two fighters and they were in an important fight and you knew the outcome of the fight, of course, you knew how to gamble on the fight so you wouldn't lose. In other words, it was a sure thing, sure bet. And so many of the mobsters made money off of the fights. They would fix those fights, of course.
How about Tommy Campbell? How did his run-in with the mob begin?
Well, Tommy actually turned pro out of Rock Island, Illinois in 1946. The guy who was his manager at that time was a numbers operator, and he was Tommy's original manager. He took Tommy out to California about 1947, and he sold his contract to a guy by the name of Babe McCoy. And Babe McCoy was a matchmaker who was not supposed to have any of his contract. And so Babe actually went out and hired two more people to look like they were the management, to be his trainer. So it was all set up that way. And then McCoy, since he was a matchmaker, he would determine which fights that Campbell fought in. And so that's the way that Tommy got connected to Babe McCoy. And he signed a 3-year contract with Babe McCoy because, see, one thing about it, if these people did not have a piece of you, you couldn't fight, no matter how good you were. So
he probably knew there was some kind of mob connection, but since he wanted to fight, he kind of went along with it at first.
Yeah, and I think when he first got there, he thought maybe it was because McCoy was so well known that he thought maybe he was just connecting with a matchmaker. He didn't know how deep this really ran.
What was the situation that happened that Tommy started balking at what the mob wanted him to do in terms of fighting?
Tommy fought a guy by the name of Luther Rollins out of Chicago, Luther Rollins, and he lost that fight. So he went to Babe McCoy. I think this might have been Tommy's like third or fourth loss or something like that. He went to Babe McCoy, and Babe McCoy tried to hold back and not give him his entire purse. So Tommy, who was normally a mild-mannered guy, got in an argument with Babe McCoy. And Babe McCoy said, yeah, I'm going to give you your money. He said, but you're through. He said, you're not going to ever fight again. And this had been Tommy's profession at this point. He's good. He's good. He's rated high. And he's basically looking at, I'll never fight again. This guy holds his contract. He's a matchmaker, and he won't sit anything for him. So just Tommy went out and tried to find a job. Anyway, a little time passed, and Babe comes back to him and says, listen, I'll give you a fight against Art Aragon, who was at that time one of the big draws. He was the original golden boy of California. And he said, but you're going to have to take a dive. And so Tommy agrees to take a dive against Art Aragon. And at a later point, he tried to get out of it. Of course, they had all these gambling things set up. And so anyway, his manager at that time, George Moore, said, hey, you can't back out. You can't back out. And that time, he began to fear for his life. And so he did go ahead and go through with that match. And he took a basically he got knocked out for the first time in his career ever. And he was probably in like his 30th fight. He got knocked out. Basically, it was all set up. And from that point, there was an investigation because it looked like it was a thrown fight. And Tommy, you know, he came up with an excuse that, Aragon hit him in the eye and he couldn't see. And that's why, you know, he went down. But he also said, I'm not throwing any more fights. But he did not tell the mob who came after him to throw another fight.
So how did he end up being on a witness stand testifying against the mob?
In March of 1956, the California state governor had been trying to bring an investigation to find out how much organized crime had infiltrated professional boxing in California. They knew it was bad, but they couldn't get anyone to talk. And they went through a series of fighters, hoping someone would testify, maybe come forth with some information, and no one would. And then finally they ran into Tommy Campbell, and they wanted to know about the Art Aragon fight from 1950. And he said, hey, I'll be happy to testify. And he said at that point that he had no more fear of those people hurting him. And he was living in Phoenix at that time. He retired in 1951, and he was working at an airplane manufacturing plant. And he came to California on his own account and began to testify against the mob. And he not only did he talk about the Art Aragon fight, he talked about two other fights that they had tried to get him to take a dive in. He just began to name names. And at that time, other boxers saw him talking, and they had the same story. And the reason I think that he didn't get in more trouble is because they started coming to testify as well. And about 7 to 8 of them came and testified on the stand after they heard Tommy Campbell. Before then, they weren't going to testify. But they were after certain people. They were after Babe McCoy. So Babe McCoy lost his license forever. He couldn't come near a boxing ring for the rest of his life.
So I guess there was some justice in all of this after all. Now, what's known once he left boxing about the rest of his life? What happened then?
After he testified in 1956, he goes back, and later he moves to Seattle, Washington, and he worked for Boeing. He becomes an avid bowler, and thought about turning professional. He was that good. In 1969, he went out to the bowling alley, and he's bowling and has a heart attack and dies at the bowling alley.
And he dies relatively young, right?
Yeah. I think he was 48. I don't think he had his 49th. It was early in the year, so yeah, he was still 48, 49 years old, somewhere in there.
Now, did you get the sense as you researched Tommy that he was bitter or angry about his boxing career kind of being cut short or him not getting the kind of recognition that he truly deserved?
Well, you know, in reading about him, I never saw where he actually said that. But he did say that there were certain fighters who said, like, for instance, Ike Williams sparred with him and said, hey, you'll never get me in the ring and take my title. And he would tell people, you know, some of the things the fighters would say. But I never got that sense. It's probably for me to see how splendid an athlete this guy was, how well-liked he was, and just to know that he never got the opportunity to really achieve at the level that he could have achieved at. I'm probably a little more angry than anybody else. You know, I think he understood that at that time, when if you got in boxing, it was very seedy profession, and you had very little control of your career. And I think he understood that, and you just kind of go as far as you can.
Phil Dixon is the author of the upcoming book, Tommy Campbell, A Boxing Bout with the Mobsters. Thanks for joining us here on KC Currents.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.